Where are we going again?
We're going to this massive, like, LED display that, like, you know what they use in The Mandalorian?
Oh, cool! Can we game on it?
Yeah, but that's not, like, really the point. It's, like, they have this, like, cool motion simulator on it. And that can, like, spin the car and stuff
like that.
That's
so cool! So,
okay, you need to drive.
Oh, sorry.
Okay. Hey, where are we going?
Taking the tunnel.
No, Linus, we're not supposed to take the tunnel! I told you! How many times do I have to tell you? Oh, my God! Oh, hey, I think we're here.
So cool, right?
Obviously, our little clip we just did wasn't to proper Hollywood North standards, but this thing is... If you guys thought that our LED display wall was cool, this is on a whole other level. Our friends at Pixelmondo just finished building their state-of-the-art display volume, and they graciously invited us here to check it out, dive into the tech that powers it, and of course, we're gonna game on it. Roll that intro!
Dude, this is so cool. You did a hand.
Us tech tips.
This is so wild, man.
If you're not familiar with the concept, a display volume is basically a massive wall, or in this case, multiple walls of LED screens that allow us to transport actors and, in our case, even entire vehicles into new worlds without the use of a green screen. This simplifies both the process of on-set lighting as well as eliminating the post-production steps of removing ugly blue or green tint from the footage that comes from using a green or a blue screen. And I gotta say, standing in it, it also makes things feel quite a lot more immersive for the talent. The particular scene behind me was created in-house in UE5, which gives them a ton of flexibility in their productions. It's a really talented crew here. And the resolution that it's being displayed at is other freaking worldly. The main back wall is just shy of 8K resolution. The top is about 6K by 3K. And then the sides are each about half of a 4K display. So like 2K by 2K. That's a freaking K-ton of pixels. But as cool as all that is with the UE5 and lots of pixels, it ain't no game yet, and I want to get these sidewalls out of the way so that I can play on the big one. How do you move that? They told us that just this one side piece weighs 1 megagram, which means that the entire setup weighs multiple tons. Don't take this the wrong way, but you don't really seem like you could lift that on your own.
Nope.
Do you want to show us how it works? Oh my God, the whole thing's floating. It's like a hover display volume. Okay. Is there like a lot? Wow, it's not even that much volume of air.
No.
Look at this freaking counterweight.
Yeah, and the weight I gave you before was just for the displays.
And it lifts it with air.
What is the pressure for this?
80 PSI.
That's it?
Yeah.
80 PSI?
It just needs 80 PSI? I guess it's 80 PSI, but that's no... What?
And the sidewalls aren't the only part that move. The entire ceiling display is on this giant gantry so that they can move it either completely out of the way if a DP comes in here and wants to do their own lighting in a grid above the set, or in the event that the car that they're shooting has a super angled windshield and they want to get the reflections just right, they can get the scene out in front of it. Now, let's game. Now you might think that just plugging a regular old laptop into a system like this is pretty complicated, and you'd actually be kind of right. While you probably assume that this is just an HDMI cable plugging into a switch of some sort or an adapter, that's not the case. In order to output to it, we actually use the Ethernet port and output over NDI, which does limit us a little bit in terms of our resolution and refresh rate, but hey, look how big it is! You guys don't have an Xbox controller, do you? Yeah, I didn't think so. Okay, hockey game on a keyboard and mouse it is. Oh wow, that is not a lot of hertz. This is so hard. Between the input latency, which is partially because they're splitting across three video processors and the 24 FPS cinematic experience, not to mention the fact that there is a car taking up a whole bunch of my viewport. If I scored a goal, it would be a miracle. God, the screen's too big. And the curvature. Oh, fun fact, man, there's so many little details that we couldn't get into. In order to get the screen curved, or to have the ability to curve it in and out, there's all these little spots for Allen keys at the back of every panel so that you can, like, adjust the angle of them. And they have these little micro spacers in between the modules. Like, there's so many little details. The image quality, though, is incredible. Like, if I could have this plugged into something that could really do 120 FPS or higher... Do we have any other games? You see the mouse? You see the mouse? That was like 150 milliseconds, guys. It reminds me of like first generation LCDs. But for a different reason. It's not that the pixel switching is slow like it was on those. It's just that the processing takes time. Actually, if anything, the pixel switching on this is near instantaneous, much like you would see on an OLED. I mean, it's LED, right? It's fast. Not an amazing gaming experience.
No, it's almost like this was built for something different.
With that said, nothing would prevent you, with the right processor and right input setup, from using a system like this for gaming, and the very, very affluent with products like Sony's MicroLED displays or Samsung's The Wall have been known to use these for their personal theaters. So we asked them to bring one down for us to take a closer look at, and immediately I'm struck by both the similarities to this panel from our LED wall and also the differences. I mean, obviously these things have to hook up to industry standard rigging, so they can't change the form factor too much from one generation to the next. But even from there, you guys can probably see a striking difference in the size of the pixels, not to mention the blacks. And there are two major factors, or well rather, three major factors that contribute to the outstanding performance. One is that as a self-emissive display, you're not bound by how much of the backlight you can block to create black, or realistically more like gray on LCD technology, but rather it's determined by how much of the background behind where the tiny LEDs are mounted the viewer can see. Of course, the second factor is how black you can make that background, and that's a big part of the special sauce behind these panels from Sony. The third is a little bit specific to this setup, and that's down to the anti-glare coating that we talked about earlier. I'm standing, here, let's just turn right around, in front of a giant bay with the sun shining in, and it still looks black. Do that with your projector. Of course, outstanding black levels are just part of the performance story, and the other part is the 1500 nits of peak brightness that we can do on these panels. And I'm not talking like on your consumer TV where it's in a 1% or a 2% window. I'm talking across the entire panel. Like, sitting under the wall of them is like baking in the sun. And it's no wonder why it feels that way, because there's over 1,000 panels in the display volume behind me, each of them consuming about 120 watts. Does it not? Oh my God. Oh, what? Whoa, you can feel the heat. I feel like I'm getting a tan. That makes your eyes go all trippy when you look at it too close. This is the effect that I've been trying to describe for so long that I saw when I got up on the stage at CES when Sony was first showing off. They used to call this the Cletus display, their mini LED line. And it's like there's a certain point where you get far enough away from it that it coalesces into just white. And then, but when you're too close, you actually see the black in between it and your eyes go all out of focus. It's really funky. Typically, these are running at 24 hertz to match the 24 frames per second that is typical in movie production. But the panels themselves are capable of thousands of refreshes per second if you had a source and a controller that was capable of driving them. Which has probably got you guys thinking, well, gee, Linus, what's the downside? Well, like anything in life, there are trade-offs. One, of course, being cost. But another major one being that with modular displays like this, you guys probably noticed in those outdoor shots there are sometimes obvious seams where the panels meet, so this might not be the best technology for your living room TV. But there's a good reason that they take this approach. Actually, two good reasons. One is that it allows productions like this one to configure the LED walls in any size, shape, and aspect ratio that they want. Another one is that it really improves the manufacturability and the serviceability. Each cabinet is made up of four modules, and if you look closely, each module is made up of four sub-modules. Micro LEDs are notoriously fragile and difficult to manufacture reliably. So, by making the individual pieces this small, they dramatically increase their yields, which lowers the cost. Yes, my friends, this is with the cost lowered. This was the broken one, right? Thank God. Well, this is a perfect opportunity for us to take a look at the back. There's a heat sink. This is cool. Redundant interfaces. Nay, not redundant, rather, so you can orient it the other way. That's so cool! Oh, what are these for?
Hydraulics. The motion platform is the heart of the Pixo Acura system and what makes it so darn cool. Using a massive hydraulic system, this thing can spin a car faster than, well, pretty much you'd ever want to be spinning in a car. And it can do a whole lot more. Using 16 physical axes, it can simulate the movement of a vehicle through all sorts of virtual terrain. Underneath are six hydraulic legs that allows this to tilt a car, or anything you put on it, up to 12 degrees. It can move it up and down or side to side by 26 centimeters as well. That might not sound like much, but when you see the car moving, and even more when you're inside of it, whew. Currently, currently it can rotate up to 8 rotations, but they're planning on getting an Ethernet slip ring that's gonna allow it to rotate up to unlimited times, infinity even, which is pretty cool. But you know, I think that 8 spins is kind of enough. I'm dizzy. And of course, each wheel can be manipulated individually using some rollers and doinkers. Using a 2.2 kilowatt motor, the rollers can spin the wheels at up to 30 kilometers an hour, which doesn't sound that fast, but just seeing it on camera makes it look pretty fast. And those doinkers, they use a 3.5 kilowatt motor that can actually move the tires up and down to simulate going over bumpy terrain. And out back for the hydraulics, we have this insane dual pump system. It uses two 75 horsepower electric motors that are pumping hydraulic fluid at a freaking crazy 2400 PSI. And it's spec'd to actually go to 4000. And if you just peek inside, you'll see a third motor that's running a coolant pump to cool all of the hydraulic fluid. Typically, they're only gonna run one motor at a time, but if they have, say, a really, really long move, like a full spin, they might run both motors. And to power those massive pumps, they need a 175 amp, 460 volt power system that's three phases. It is truly crazy, and the cables are very scary, but also color-coded. And the entire platform is controlled from this desk here by motion systems engineer Brisa. From here, the car can be choreographed using custom software, accounting for every little detail that you might want in the movement. They can also just move it on the fly if they need. They've even demoed using a sim racing rig with someone driving in like a video game to send feedback from the game to the car. This all ties into a larger system that makes use of motion capture as well as internal coordinates to make sure that everything here operates in sync. We'll talk about that in a second. But right now, let's talk about the TechnoDolly 25. These sorts of motorized camera cranes are not something really that new, but the TechnoDolly 25 is one of just four in the entire world. It is frame accurate to plus or minus 0.2 millimeters. It can move along the tracks at 6.2 feet per second. The boom can extend to 26 feet at 6.4 feet per second, and it can do this while carrying a 75 pound camera payload. What they're using right now is a Sony FX9, which is essentially a big boy version of the cameras that we are actually shooting this very take on right now. It can basically move any way you want, and it's programmed using keyframes in this system. Basically, any move can be programmed and recalled using this very, very special bespoke software. It allows you to control every facet of the system, and it also comes with this, which they call the pickle. If you need the general idea of what you're trying to do, you can use the pickle, and if you need the precision, you can come to the TechnoDolly programming system. It's cool. Look, that's us. This is how he programmed it. There's all the keyframes.
But as amazing as all of that is, we haven't even seen the coolest part. This glorious bay door that I'm standing in front of. Guys, it gets so flipping hot in here. No, I'm kidding. The beating heart of this entire setup, the server room. Good Lord, is it ever loud in here? Wow! Can barely hear myself think. But who needs to think when the computers can think for us? Inside each one of these render nodes is two NVIDIA Ada 6000 GPUs that are all synchronized to output to the video wall. And we can actually crack one of them open. They were willing to set it up for us, so we could open it up and give you guys a look inside. This one's got just one Ada GPU in it because it's meant to act as more of a cold spare in case anything else goes down, but it still gives us a good look at what their requirements are. So in each one of these machines, in addition to their GPUs, they have a Threadripper CPU, 256 gigs of quad channel memory, and redundant boot drives, as well as 8 terabytes, whoops, of high-speed NVMe storage. As you guys can imagine, a lot of data flows through this place. But how does it flow? To answer that, we've got to come around to the back of these fine servers. Well, I got to say, damn, girl, you hot. But literally, though, I don't think it's even rendering anything that heavy right now. Here we can see our GPUs, which output into these DisplayPort to fiber optic boxes, which run up the cabinet to the patch panels at the front and out of the room over to the wall. But perhaps more importantly, we've got these sync cards. Let's step out of here and I'll tell you about this. It really is very hot back here. You guys may remember the concept of synchronization cards from way back when we did 12K gaming. Unlike SLI, NVIDIA's commercial solutions are less concerned about maximum performance and more concerned about precision. So what a sync card allows you to do is take either an internal or an external clock signal and make sure that all of the GPUs are communicating at all times going, hey, I'm done that super easy part of the scene. I'm all done rendering. You guys ready yet? Whoa, whoa, whoa. Hold on a second. I got all the heavy stuff with all the reflections and particle effects. Give me a minute so that they can all output at the same time. Because if they didn't, you'd be looking at screen tearing on steroids with entire sections of your screen just like flipping to the next frame before the others are ready. And the precision that you need is unbelievable. We've talked before about cards with atomic clocks on them to allow data centers to maintain all of their servers in perfect sync. Well, that's not good enough for these guys. No, no. They have a GPS antenna outside the building so that they can be constantly tapped in. Oh yeah, we haven't even shown where all the data runs go. Come on. For safety and durability, everything is bundled up into an orange split loom. That's the universal code for fiber inside. Be very careful, please. And it all goes down across here to this small cabinet. They were kind enough to rip the side panels off so we could show you guys exactly how it's routed. We've got about 5 pairs of fiber optics coming into this patch panel right here. And then this side of the patch panel is going out to the display wall. If you guys recall, the industry standard isn't to run HDMI cables to the individual panels, but rather RJ45 jacks. So that's where these come in. These are part of Netgear's AV line of switches, and they take a 10 gig link from our little cabinet there and split that out into 12 2.5 gig links, each of which powers half of one column of our display panels. So these come out along the bottom, they go in, and then they're daisy chained with each of our 2.5 gig links powering 7 of our panels. I mean, I shouldn't say power. Power is actually handled by these thick boys. I mean, powered in a data sense. Halfway up the wall, you'll find another switch that powers the second half of these columns. So the entire back of the wall is dotted with these network switches. Of course, some of these things are not like the other. This one, for instance, is part of Netgear's AV line, but also has PoE++, which allows it to run, that's right, my friends, the motion capture camera system over there, which feeds back all the way into the server room. Of course, none of this works without the fine people behind it, so I just wanted to include one more shout-out. Thank you so much, Pixomondo, for being part of this. If everyone wants to just, I don't know, in show business, we, like, take a bow or something, or... Sure. Well, actually, no, sorry, I didn't mean you guys. I meant the real star of the show.
Woo! Yeah! Woo! Woo! Yeah!
Which leaves only one person left to thank, and that is, of course, our sponsor. If you guys enjoyed this video, why not check out the time we built our LED display wall? It is not as good.
And it doesn't even have a car in front of it.
But it was a lot cheaper. Oh, yeah. And we had fun.
That's what really matters. Fun.